Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program today, we're going to be speaking with Ben Clemmy of the Santa Fe Youth Symphony and young composer Alexandra Bryant about the upcoming concert of the Santa Fe Youth Symphony. I'd like now to welcome Alfredo Jarre. He is an artist. He will be giving a lecture tonight, Monday, at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe at 6 o'clock. And he will also be giving a workshop with the Santa Fe Art Institute from December 9th through 12th. And for more information about that, you can call the Santa Fe Art Institute at 424-5050. Alfredo, welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here with you.
You were born in Chile. You are the recipient of numerous awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and a MacArthur Fellowship, and you do public interventions. Tell us about interventions. What was the first intervention you ever did? What were you intervening in?
My first public intervention took place in Chile. We were living under the dictatorship, and of course, all the public spaces for exhibitions were under control by the dictatorship. So as artists, we were looking to reach a larger audience and to keep active. So I never studied art, I studied architecture, and so for me, it was a logical step to get out of the museum, which was under control, to get out of the galleries, which were inexistent, and start working in the streets and in public spaces. So those were my first projects.
And so what kind of projects did you do in the streets and in public spaces?
Well, because of the dictatorship and the censorship, we could not say in a very clear way what we wanted to say. Of course, we were opposing the dictatorship, and we were asking for democracy, but those were forbidden words. So we learn how to speak in between the lines. So I did some very political interventions, but they were highly poetic, where we suggested more than we announced it clearly, because we were taking the risk of being arrested and taken to prison, and who knows what. So they're all very poetic, and my most well-known is one where I decided to divide Chile in half with 1,000 Chilean flags. So we put the flags in the ground from the mountains to the sea, and the last flags are buried under the water in the sea. And with that piece, it was a very poetic gesture, very beautiful, but it was my way to suggest that the country was divided in half, and I wanted to articulate visually that division, because believe it or not, half of the Chilean population was happy with Pinochet, and they wanted Pinochet to remain, and the other half wanted a return to democracy, and there was no dialogue between the two sides. So I felt a country where there is no dialogue is really preparing itself to commit suicide. There must be dialogue. Dialogue and communication was key, and this lack of dialogue made me want to illustrate this in the most poetic and dramatic way, this division between the two sides dividing the country.
Did your project and other projects that you did actually foster the dialogue that you were hoping for?
Well, the effect of what we can do as artists is quite limited. And of course, during the dictatorship, it was limited. But we believed at the time that it was important to occupy every single space available to us, to show those that thought about us and like us, that there were still spaces of resistance, that there were still spaces of hope, that there were still people out there thinking like they were thinking. So it was very important to keep those spaces alive. And we did as much as we could. And of course, you know, a democratic movement was born, and that democratic movement brought down the dictatorship by the late 90s.
You know, whether it be Chile, whether it be Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union in its time, there's always this fine line that artists are walking in making art that some people can understand and yet that the dictatorship is either not going to understand or not going to object to. You know, how do you do that? I mean, is the dictatorship understanding what you're doing when you make pieces like that?
Well, you know, artists, we are capable of using a language that is sophisticated enough for certain people to actually not understand it, because the language of contemporary art is quite complex. So basically, I think that at the time, the dictatorship didn't care much about culture. They were looking at the big picture, but they were not, you know, following every work by every single artist. And so I was very young, and so I was probably under the radar, and I was able to do these works. And besides, remember, these works are very evocative. They just evoke, they just suggest. We couldn't go further, and that was the key to the survival of these works.
Let's talk about some of the more recent works you've done. I was reading about them in sort of no particular order. There was one that I found fascinating, which was that you did in Sweden, and you went to a town in Sweden called Skoghall, and it was a place where there was not a lot of art, and so the idea was that you would build a contemporary Kunsthalle, an art hall, with paper produced by their paper mill, and then burn it down. Tell us about that project. What was the concept, and what happened? I mean, what was so fascinating about it to me was there was such a dialogue between you and the people of the town about art that had never been there before.
Right. I was invited to do a public intervention in this little town, and this is a company town that was created by a paper mill 30 years ago. This town did not exist, and the paper mill decided to install there their biggest headquarters and start producing paper. So today you have 80,000 inhabitants, and the entire economy of the town revolves around the mill, because it's a larger paper mill in the world, and so it's a very important economically for the life of the town. And so in my research, I immediately discovered that the paper mill had financed all the infrastructure of the town, hospitals, schools, etc., etc., but there was no space for culture. So I refused the funding that was being offered to me by the city, and I requested a meeting with the board of directors of the paper mill. And I suggested to them in that meeting that it was coherent, it was the logical thing to do for them to sponsor a museum, because they had sponsored everything else. And I would like to design and build the first paper museum in the world. They accepted my suggestion, they were very generous, and they paid for this small museum. And so we built it, and on a site given to us by the city, and we inaugurated it with 15 works by young Swedish artists from all around Sweden. And it was inaugurated by the mayor of the city, and of course the entire town population came to see it. And exactly 24 hours later, we burned it down. The logic was to offer the community only a glimpse of what contemporary art is, and then once they had seen it, to take it away. Because I was not going to impose a cultural institution to a community that didn't want one, that never thought about having one. I just wanted to suggest to them, and in a most dramatic way, what it is to lack a space for art and culture. And it was a very beautiful project in a sense that the community reacted very well, and a year after my project, they selected my museum as the most important building in their town, even though it had disappeared. And 6 years later, they invited me back as an architect to design the permanent Kunsthalle for Skoghall, and it will open in 2012.
And so as a result of this, the making of the museum and the burning of it, they realized that they really wanted and needed art in their lives.
Exactly. And so I, in my project, my objective was to dramatize the lack of culture in that community and to give them just a taste of it, but I was not going to impose it. That's why we did it in paper, so we could burn it.
Now, there was a similar project. Well, I don't know how similar it was, but there was a project you did in Niigata, Japan, which was also a response to the lack of contemporary art museums in that part of Japan. What did you see there, and what did you do?
Yeah, here the situation was different. It's a very large area of Japan. It's called Niigata Prefecture, and it's around 750 square kilometers area. And also, this is an entire area without museums. And it's a very poor area, and the administration of the prefecture of Niigata wanted to attract tourists to their area, and they didn't know how to do it. So I proposed the design and construction of not only one museum, but 12 museums. But of course, because we didn't have the budget to do 12 major museums, we decided to create the smallest museum in the world, and each one would simply show a single work of art. So we created these 12 museums and put them around Niigata, offering the tourist that comes to Niigata the possibility of traveling around and to discover these museums. And in discovering this museum, they would discover the beautiful landscape of Niigata, and they would try different hotels, different restaurants, and they would see the entire region. So it was really a pretext for attracting people and do this through culture. And it also responded to another preoccupation of mine. People inside museum is always rushing. And I really get frustrated with this fact. The average time that a spectator spends in front of an artwork is 3 seconds. So artists spend their life working on an artwork, and people go into a museum and they just rush in front of it. So these single structures that house a single work of art allows me to create a space of contemplation. People come in, they sit, and there is nothing more to see than a single work of art and the landscape. So this was a way to show also how much I care about art and how important it is in our lives, and to give a space dedicated to a single work of art. So it was a combination of creating art and giving it a respectful space, and also as a pretext for people to travel around Niigata and discover this beautiful landscape.
And so what happened? Did it work out the way that you hoped?
We were able to realize a single prototype, which worked very well, and that's when the money stopped, and it was never realized further. So if they find the funding, we will be able to actually build the 12 museums in different areas of Niigata. So it remained at the prototype level, and we were able to build a single museum.
On a completely different note, there was a project you did which involved a logo in Times Square, Logo for America. This was years ago. Which had a kind of outline of the United States and then said, this is not America. For you as a Chilean, you're an American, where everyone in North and South America is American, but people in this country sometimes forget about that.
Yes, that became my most reproduced project, and actually I'm proud to say that it is in 37 school books in this country to explain this problem. For people from Latin America and from Central America, the word America is magical. It is filled with poetry, and it is very meaningful because it's what defines us. We are all Americanos, and America is a continent, is not a country. And when I arrived in this country, early 80s, I was shocked to discover that in the daily language of the people and of the media, the word America was used to refer only to this country and not to the entire continent. So you would hear, welcome to America, or God bless America, etc., etc. So in the language, the rest of the continent was erased from the map. And I wanted to correct that. So when I was offered the opportunity to do a public project in Times Square in 1987, I did this piece called A Logo for America, where I make this correction and I suggest that the United States is not America. America is a continent. And I end up with an image that shows America being the entire continent. But of course, you see, the use of language is nothing more than a reflection of a geopolitical reality of domination of the rest of the continent by this country. So it is a very difficult thing to change. And the language will change only when the relationship between this country and the rest of the continent will change. The most spectacular reaction was that National Public Radio did a six-minute story on that piece. And so the journalists went to Times Square and interviewed people live in the program, asking them, what do you think about this project up there on the sign? And you could hear people live on National Public Radio responding, this is illegal. How could he do this? So you see, there is a huge lack of communication, a huge lack of education about this issue. And as I say, I don't know what else we can do about this. I'm afraid it's too late.
We're talking to Alfredo Jarre, who will be giving a lecture tonight at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe at 6 o'clock. It's part of a larger project by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Well, this is, and the whole series that the Santa Fe Art Institute is doing is about tourism and migration and exile. And here you are from Chile. You're here. You did a project some years ago, a few years ago, called The Cloud, which was right on the border of the United States and Mexico. I guess it was in the year 2000. Tell us about that project.
Yes, some 3,000 people died in the last 10 years simply trying to cross the border between Mexico and the United States. They died because of shootings by immigration, exhaustion, or drowning. Finally, they died because they are hit by cars when they arrive to the U.S. side and they have to cross a highway that is 8, 10, or 12 lanes wide. And so I think it's a scandal that in the 21st century people die simply trying to cross a border between two countries. And in particular, in the Tijuana-San Diego area, death is banal. It's not even reported. People die every day, and it's not even the news. They are ignored because it's poor people. They are nameless people. So I wanted to do an homage to those people who have died and to create a space of mourning. And so I work with seven non-government organizations, four Mexican and three from the United States, that were working with the immigrants. And we invited the relatives of the victims to attend this ceremony. And the project was called The Cloud. And we created a cloud with 3,000 balloons inflated with helium. So it was a very large cloud, and we suspended this cloud above the fence between the two countries. And we did a beautiful poetic ceremony on the Mexican side on a plateau called the Valley of Death, El Valle de la Muerte, because it's an area where a lot of crossing occurs and a lot of death occurs. So we started the ceremony with a concert, with classical music, and then some poetry readings. And then after that, the cloud opened up magically in the air, and all the balloons were released. And the wind in that area was supposed to take the balloons towards the water. And so I had worked with some scientists who had helped me create these biodegradable balloons because we didn't want to affect the fish in the water. So we were prepared for that. But that day, the wind shifted and the balloons went towards Mexico. It was a very moving sight to see the balloons going to Mexico, and a lot of people was very moved and cried, and for them, it was Maria, Roberto, Julio, and Laura going back home.
Very interesting with a work of art like that, where unpredictability ends up being such a beautiful metaphor.
One thing I've learned as a public artist is that you can design everything. You can plan everything to the last detail. But in the end, you lose control. And because it's happening in a public space, and anything can happen. And this is a case where something really special happened, almost like a sign from heaven.
What kind of, and this is maybe a little bit off the topic of your art and the art world, but what kind of unity or lack of unity do you see among the Spanish-speaking countries of Latin America?
Well, you know, most of them speak Spanish, the only one speaking Portuguese. But besides this, there are so many differences. We are like the Europe of Latin America.
Right.
There are many, many differences. The language unites us, but I can tell you that the difference between a Chilean like me and a Colombian is as wide as between a French and a British, or a French and a Spanish. The culture is very different, and the education is very different, and the outlook is very different. So, you know, people in this country has this sad and tendency to look south of the border and think we're all the same and it's the same thing, you know. But it is so far from the truth. There are very beautiful and rich identities to be discovered in every single country.
And at the same time, when you have an imperial country like the United States treating all of Latin America as if it were one thing, there is sort of an opportunity for a kind of unity, even if it's only unity in protest.
Exactly, and what you see happening in Latin America is extraordinary, and it is related to the fact that we are treated as one thing. So when this country wakes up and starts looking south, after being so worried and busy looking at the Middle East, they will realize that a lot of the countries have become very progressive in their governments and their administrations, and the continent is moving toward the left in a very progressive way, and they are uniting under the leadership of Lula, who is the president of Brazil, and Michelle Bachelet, a woman president of Chile. And so there is a huge progressive movement in Latin America, and this is happening under the radar of what's happening here. And so when this country wakes up, and I'm sure it will under the Obama administration, they will discover a very different landscape in Latin America.
We're talking to Alfredo Jarre. There was another piece that I wanted you to talk about called Lights in the City, which you did in Montreal, in which a whole lot of red lights were installed in the cupola of a monumental building in Montreal. And then those lights were turned on under surprising circumstances. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a project called Lights in the City. And here I wanted to give visibility to the homeless population, which at the time was 15,000 homeless people. And I had been invited to do a project in this monument, which is called the cupola. And I had started discussing with the homeless population of three shelters that are around this cupola, in the 200 or 300 meters radius around the cupola. And, of course, in the discussion, they told me that they don't want to be represented photographically because they were ashamed of their condition. And, of course, they didn't want me to photograph them. So I was looking for a way to give them visibility, but without exposing them. physically and visually. So we came up with this idea of putting 100,000 watts of red light inside this cupola and to install a device in the three shelters. And every time a homeless man entered this shelter, they had the possibility, if they wished, to push this button, and the lights would go red in the cupola for just a fraction of a second, sending a signal to the entire city that another man was entering another shelter. So it was a way to keep their presence in these shelters alive without exposing them personally and physically to the gaze of the audience. And so we made the front pages of all the newspapers and magazine and TV programs, and all the other shelters in the city wanted to join us to transform this monument into a monument of shame and to keep this light going red all the time as a sign of protest until the city would do something about homelessness. But after 6 weeks, the mayor said enough is enough, and he stopped the project. But we can say that for those 6 weeks, the homeless situation was visible because this was a portrait of homelessness without exposing them physically.
And the brilliant thing is that because of all the media coverage, everybody knew what it was. So instead of just pretty lights in a pretty building, it became a meaningful thing that virtually everybody knew about.
Right. And some of the younger homeless kids, they would sit in chairs around this device and spend the entire evening talking and dreaming about a better world and pushing that button every 5 seconds to make sure that the light were on all the time. So it became a tool for them to announce their presence. Because, as you know, homeless people are invisible. They become part of the urban landscape. They become part of urban furniture. They are there in the streets asking for money, and we ignore them. We just don't see them. So this was a way for me to give them visibility, to create a portrait of homelessness, but without exposing them physically to your gaze.
We're talking to Alfredo Jarre, an artist who will be in the College of Santa Fe's Tipton Hall tonight with the Santa Fe Art Institute at 6 o'clock. You did a project called the Rwanda Project, which took place over a period of 6 years. And part of that project was that there were photographs that were real pictures, but you didn't show them. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Rwanda Project was born out of my frustration with the media and with the lack of reaction by the so-called international community. 1 million people were killed in the space of 100 days, and no one reacted. Some of the media displayed some of these images of horror, but no one saw them. No one reacted. No one wanted to get involved. And 1 million people died in the face of the criminal indifference of the world community. So I went to Rwanda to investigate and to witness the aftermath of the genocide, and I took the most horrific pictures I had ever taken in my life. And when I came back, I was at a loss. How do I communicate what I experienced? How do I do that? How do I represent what most people didn't care about or didn't want to see? So one of the first projects of my Rwanda project consisted of a series of monuments dedicated to the memory of the people of Rwanda. And these monuments consisted of black archival boxes that contain some of my pictures. But the boxes were closed, and on top of each box, we had seal screen, a text describing the image inside the box. And with these boxes, using them as modules, as bricks, we created these monuments, and we displayed them in dark spaces with very small light spots on them, created a kind of religious, spiritual atmosphere, inviting people to look at these monuments and to simply read the text, but not look at the images. It was a kind of a reverse strategy. I thought, well, these images were shown to you. You didn't see them because you didn't react. Perhaps now that I'm hiding them, you will see them better. So that was the logic of that project, the first in a series of 25 projects in 6 years dedicated to the Rwandan genocide.
Did that reverse psychology work?
I think it did. It moved a lot of people, and there were very beautiful reactions. We had index cards in one of the spaces so people could react, and it was very positively received by the audience and by the critics in general, and that work has been shown all over the world, and it has been written extensively about by the media and by critics and by photography specialists.
You your work is shown all over the world. Have been in many museums and galleries and exhibitions, and you talk about the responsibility of the art world to take on political issues. When the art world is such a big category, it's such a big concept, I mean, a lot of the art world stays very far away from that. How do you see both the art world's responsibility and what they're actually doing right now?
Yeah, the image that the media in general gives of the art world is quite pathetic. It gives an image of a few art stars that are quite eccentric, that are quite into fashion and into spectacular things and glamorous lives. And to tell you the truth, this has nothing to do with the real art world. Now, the tragedy is that the art world, which is an industry, which should know more, we should know better about image and how to communicate a good image to society at large, fails to do that. So the art world, tragically, has a communication problem, has an image problem, because the art world is a system of many, many, many small systems. And so the only little system that the media cares about is the one I mentioned before, the glamorous one, the fashionable one, the spectacular one, the rich one. But all the others are the most interesting ones. They are the thinkers, the dreamers, people trying to change the world, creating new ways of thinking, new models of thinking, new ways of looking at the world, thinking about societies, asking questions, moving people to think, moving people to action, giving a dream, creating dreams, and giving new models of thinking about the world. That is the real art world. But you never hear about that art world in the media. And as I say, we have a communication problem.
So you are here to help us remedy that here when you're in Santa Fe. I wanted to ask you before you go, what are you doing now? What is your latest project that you're working on?
I'm preparing my next exhibition for New York, which opens in March. It's going to be a large installation, quite complex technologically, and it's dedicated to a single image. So I will offer the audience the time and the space and the media to think about the effect of an image, its history, and how it communicates and how it affects us. So it's a piece that will be shown in March in New York. So I'm working on that, and I'm working on a couple of retrospectives for Berlin, and another one for Cincinnati Art Center.
And you will be here in Santa Fe once again tonight at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall, giving a lecture. 6 o'clock, the Santa Fe Art Institute can be found on the web at sfai.org, and their phone number is 424-5050. And you'll be teaching a workshop from Tuesday through Friday of this week. What's the nature of the workshop?
The particularities of my workshops is that I don't come with any preconceived notions of what I will do. What I do is that the first few hours of the workshop, I tried to learn from the participants to understand who they are, what they have done, what they hope to accomplish, what are their dreams as artists, as thinkers. And then I designed the workshop specifically for the participants of the workshop. And so it means a lot of very fast improvisation, but I've been doing this for many, many years. It has become a trademark of mine, and I feel it's very important to respond to the participants' needs instead of coming up with some ideas of mine and just ask the students to react.
Alfredo Jarre, thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR at Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I would like now to welcome Ben Clemmy. He is the music director of the Santa Fe Youth Symphony, and he's here in Santa Fe, obviously. And joining us by telephone from Houston is Alexandra Bryant. She's a composer whose new piece called Blue Doors is going to premiere on Sunday, December 14th, here in Santa Fe at 3:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having us this afternoon, Mary Charlotte.
Let's talk to you, Ben, first. What is the Santa Fe Youth Symphony? I guess it's more than just symphony music.
Absolutely. The Santa Fe Youth Symphony Association is an organization that is celebrating its 15th season this year. The organization as a whole encompasses an orchestral arm, a jazz arm, and a beginning instrumental instruction arm. We have three string orchestras ranging from age about 6 to age 18 through high school. So we have young elementary school students performing in string orchestras, and then we have the Youth Symphony Orchestra, which is the orchestra that I conduct, which is high school students exclusively. We also have two jazz bands, the Charlie Parker Jazz Ensemble and the Miles Davis Jazz Ensemble. And we have a program in the public schools where we go into the schools for 1 hour twice a week at 5 public Santa Fe schools and teach beginning and intermediate violin courses. So we have a lot of things going on throughout the city of Santa Fe, and we're excited to be celebrating our 15th anniversary.
Now, do the students who participate, the young people who participate in all these different ensembles, do they come in already trained, or do you also provide instruction?
Many of our students do come in already trained, but we also provide beginning and you know, developing instruction for those students who have yet to gain the skill to perform in our ensembles.
And so when you are working with young people doing symphonic, you know, classical music, what kinds of pieces do you choose to meet their level so that they're going to sound the best they can?
It's a really exciting process selecting repertoire for me, because I have the joy of working with very intelligent and curious and talented young high school students, and it's just a joy selecting music that will both meet their ability level and challenge them and help them to grow musically. It's just a wonderful part of my job, and just imagining what we can perform and what we can bring into the lives of these young people.
So what are some examples?
So in this next performance that we have coming up on the 14th, the Youth Symphony Orchestra will be performing a piece by Aaron Copland from his ballet Billy the Kid. The piece is Celebration Dance. And we will also be performing work by Gabriel Fauré, which is a solo for cello and orchestra. The soloist is Pecos Singer. He's the principal cellist of the Youth Symphony, and he won a concerto competition for the honor to perform with the Youth Symphony. So Pecos will perform the Elegy by Fauré. And we will also be playing a charming little piece by the American composer Leroy Anderson called The Typewriter, where the soloist performs on an old manual typewriter, and we will also be...
It's not a symphonic instrument imitating a typewriter.
No, it's an actual typewriter, which is just a riot to do. It's a fun piece, and our principal trumpet player will be playing the solo typewriter part, so it's just a great little piece of Americana. And we will be closing with selections from Bizet's Carmen, the suites that he wrote for orchestra from that opera. But we're here today because we'll be performing a commission by Alexandra, Blue Doors, which has been written for our orchestra.
So let's turn to Alexandra. You are a composer, I guess, based in Houston. Tell us about this piece, Blue Doors. We're going to hear some of your music in just a moment.
This piece for me was really meant to be celebratory, as Ben had, when he approached me, mentioned that it was for their 15th anniversary celebration concert. So I wanted it to be not only fun, but in some ways kind of be an homage to Copland, in a sense, and knowing that Ben was programming Copland on the concert as well, it seems kind of fitting. And I've never been to Santa Fe, and so I did a lot of searches of pictures for landscapes, and I kept actually getting pictures of buildings with doors that were the color of blue predominantly.
Ah.
And so that really stuck out to me, and kind of wanting, I mean, that was the best thing I could come up with, as bad as that sounds in some ways, but I thought it would be kind of cool to imitate that and kind of give it not necessarily a country feeling in the sense of country music, but kind of the open space. And that's really, those things all kind of tied together to make this kind of an upbeat, lively, fun piece for the kids to play.
Do you ever have the experience listening to or composing or playing music where you close your eyes and you actually see or feel colors that are associated with the music?
I can understand the concept of it, but I don't necessarily. It's mostly for me kind of going to another place, not necessarily envisioning a specific color, but kind of a feeling that something evokes, maybe a past emotion or an event, or just kind of taking myself maybe to the location that it was actually composed in or the era in which it was composed in, but not necessarily a color connotation. No.
Now, you have been playing the violin since you were very young. Do you
Yes.
find that you're drawn especially to composing for the violin?
I like writing a lot of string music, so yes. And it's definitely a major focus for me, string music is.
Tell us more about your early studies, and your studies, you know, up until this day. You studied violin, and how did you start composing music?
I started composing music around high school, and it was because when I would listen to music, I was never completely satisfied with the outcome of it. I wanted it to do something different. I didn't like what I expected to come because it didn't come. And a lot of times I would find satisfaction and joy in music, but I wanted it to be slightly different, slightly adjusted. And that was my best way to express my feelings. Just, I wanted to make my own changes to it. So that's kind of how it came about.
Isn't that interesting? So who would you say are your most influential composers on your music?
I have so many, but I would definitely have to note Vaughan Williams, Shostakovich, Barber, and Copland as four big ones.
Why don't we listen to a little bit of your music right now, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
And we just listened to The Tale That Casts a Shadow by Alexandra Bryant, who is still with us by telephone, and who is the composer whose new piece, Blue Doors, will premiere with the Santa Fe Youth Symphony Concert on Saturday, December 14th at 3:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium. I guess this is maybe a similar sound to the piece Blue Doors, Alexandra?
I would say it's very similar in a lot of respects, yes. It has a similar feeling and kind of similar connotations to me.
It's great for me to hear this piece that we just listened to again, because it was The Tale That Casts a Shadow that brought Alexandra and I together, really, for the first time as colleagues, as musicians. And it's great to extend our working relationship together here with Blue Doors and the Santa Fe Youth Symphony.
And you will be here actually joining the musicians for a dress rehearsal before the piece is performed.
I will be. I will be flying in on Thursday and spending the weekend involved in everything they need me to be.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here on the radio. Alexandra Bryant is a composer, and Ben Clemmie is the music director of the Santa Fe Youth Symphony, which can be found on the web at sfys.org. And the phone number over there is 982-8483. And once again, the concert on Sunday, December 14th at 3:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium is free. Thank you both so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us with you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the air at ksfr.org. You can reach me by email at radiocafe@ksfr.org, or you can leave a message at the telephone 428-1528. We are podcasting, and my website is santafe.radiocafe.org. You can listen to the show there anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can go there and subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, The Colors of Jazz. We will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Hasta la vista.